He looked back. Carlotte Dan Eider was already crossing the gangway. Well, perhaps just one of us will. "Things are going well," sang Koska in his rich Styrian accent, grinning out over the parapet at the carnage beyond the walls. "A good day's work yesterday, considering." A good day's work. Below them, on the other side of the ditch, the bare earth was scarred and burned, bristling with spent flatbow bolts, like stubble on a brown chin. Everywhere, siege equipment lay wrecked and ruined. Broken ladders, fallen barrows, spilling rocks, burned and shattered wicker screens, trampled into the hard dirt. The shell of one of the great siege towers was still half standing, a framework of blackened timbers sticking twisted from a heap of ash, scorched and tattered leather flapping in the salt wind. "We taught those Gurkish fuckers a lesson they won't soon forget, eh, Superior?" "What lesson?" muttered Severard. What lesson indeed. The dead learn nothing. The corpses were dotted about before the Gurkish front line, 200 strides or so from the land walls. They were scattered across the no man's land between, surrounded by a flotsam of broken weapons and armour. They had dropped so heavily just before the ditch that you could almost have walked from the sea on one side of the peninsula to the sea on the other without once stepping on the earth. In a few places, they were crowded together into huddled groups. Where the wounded crawled to take cover behind the dead, then bled to death themselves. Glockta had never seen slaughter like it. Not even after the siege of Ulrioch, when the breach had been choked with Union dead, when Gurkish prisoners had been murdered by the score, when the temple had been burned with hundreds of citizens inside. Corpses sagged and lolled and sprawled, some charred with fire, some bent in attitudes of final prayer, some spread out, heedless, heads smashed by rocks flung from above. Some had clothes ripped and rooted through, where they tore at their own shirts to check their wounds, hoping they were not fatal. All of them disappointed. Flies buzzed in legions around the bodies. Birds of 100 species hopped and flapped and pecked at the unexpected feast. Even here, high up in the blasting wind, it was starting to reek. The stuff of nightmares. Of my nightmares for the next few months, I shouldn't wonder. If I last that long. Glockta felt his eye twitching, and he blew out a deep breath, stretched his neck from side to side. Well, we must fight on. It is a little late now for second thoughts. He peered gingerly over the parapet to take a look down at the ditch, his free hand grasping tight at the pitted stone to keep his balance. Not good. They have nearly filled the channel down below us, and over near the gates. True, said Koska cheerfully. They drag up their boxes of rocks and try to tip them in. We can only kill them so fast. That channel is our best defense. True again. It was a good idea, but nothing lasts forever. Without it, there is nothing to stop the Gurkish mounting ladders, rolling up rams, mining under our walls even. It might be necessary to organize a sortie of some kind. Dig it back out. Koska rolled his dark eyes sideways. Lowered from the wall by ropes, slaving in the darkness, not 200 strides from the Gurkish positions? Was that what you had in mind? Something like that. Then I wish you luck with it, Glockta snorted. I would go, of course. He tapped his leg with his cane. But I'm afraid my days of heroics are far behind me. Lucky for you. Hardly. We should build a barricade behind the gates. That is our weakest point. A half circle, I would guess, some 100 strides across, would make an effective killing ground. If they manage to break through, we might still contain them there long enough to push them back. Might. Ah, pushing them back. Koska scratched at the rash on his neck. I'm sure the volunteers will be falling over each other for that duty when the time comes. Still, I'll see it done. You have to admire them. General Visbrook strode up to the parapet, his hands clasped tightly behind his impeccably pressed uniform. I'm surprised he finds the time for presentation with things as they are. Still, we all cling to what we can. He shook his head as he peered down at the corpses. Some courage to come at us like this over and over against defenses so strong and so well manned. I've rarely seen men so willing to give their lives. They have that most strange and dangerous of qualities, said Koska. They think they're in the right. Visbrook stared sternly out from under his brows. It is we who are in the right. If you like. The mercenary grinned sideways at Glockter. But I think the rest of us long ago gave up on the idea that there's any such thing. The plucky Gurkish come on with their barrows, and it's my job to shoot them full of arrows. He barked out a sharp laugh. I don't think that's amusing, snapped Visbrook. A fallen opponent should be treated with respect. Why? Because it could be any one of us rotting in the sun, and probably soon will be. Koska only laughed the louder and clapped Visbrook on the arm. Now you're getting it. If I've learned one thing from 20 years of warfare, it's that you have to look at the funny side. Glockter watched the Styrian chuckling at the battlefield. Trying to decide when would be the best time to change sides. Trying to work out how good a fight to give the Gurkish before they pay better than I do. There's more than rhymes in that scabby head, but for the moment we cannot do without him. He glanced at General Visbrook, who had moved further down the walkway to sulk on his own. Our plump friend has neither the brains nor the bravery to hold this city for longer than a week. He felt a hand on his shoulder and turned back to Koska. What? He snapped. Muttered the mercenary, pointing up into the blue sky. Glockter followed his finger. There was a black spot up there, not far above them, but moving upwards. What is that, a bird? It had peaked now and was coming down. Realization dawned suddenly. A stone from a catapult. It grew larger as it fell, tumbling over and over, seeming to move with ridiculous slowness, as if sinking through water, its total silence adding to the sense of unreality. Glockter watched it open-mouthed. They all did. An air of terrible expectancy settled on the walls. It was impossible to tell exactly where the stone was going to fall. Men began to scatter this way and that along the walkway, clattering, scuffling, gasping and squealing, tossing away weapons. Fuck, whispered Severard, throwing himself face down on the stones. Glockter stayed where he was, his eyes locked on that one dark spot in the bright sky. Is it coming for me? Several tons of rock about to splatter my remains across the city? What a ludicrously random way to die. He felt his mouth twitch up in a faint smile. There was a deafening crash as a section of parapet was ripped apart nearby, sending out a cloud of dust and flinging chunks of stone into the air. Splinters whizzed around them. A soldier, not 10 strides away, was neatly decapitated by a flying block. His headless body swayed for a moment on its feet before its knees buckled and it toppled backwards off the wall. The missile crashed down somewhere in the lower city, smashing through the shacks, bouncing and rolling, flinging shattered timbers up like matchsticks, leaving a trail of destruction in its wake. Glockter blinked and swallowed. His ears were still ringing, but he could hear someone shouting. A strange voice, a Styrian accent. Koska. That the best you can do, you fuckers! I'm still here! The Gurkish are bombarding us! Visbrook was squealing pointlessly, squatting down behind the parapet with his hands clasped over his head, a layer of light dust across the shoulders of his uniform. Solid shot from their catapults! You don't say, muttered Glockter. There was another mighty crash as a second rock struck the walls further down and burst apart in a shower of fragments, hurling stones the size of skulls into the water below. The very walkway beneath Glockta's feet seemed to tremble with the force of it.
"They're coming again!"
Koska was roaring at the very top of his voice.
"Man the walls! To the walls!"
Men began to hurry past, natives, mercenaries, Union soldiers, all side by side, cranking their flatbows, handing out bolts, shouting and calling to one another in a confusion of different languages. Koska moved among them, slapping backs, shaking his fist, snarling and laughing with not the slightest sign of fear. A most inspiring leader for a half-mad drunkard.
"Fuck this!" hissed Severard in Glockta's ear. "I'm no damn soldier."
"Neither am I any more, but I can still enjoy a show." He limped up to the parapet and peered out. This time he saw the catapult's great arm fly up in the distant haze. The distance was poorly judged this time, and it sailed high overhead. Glockta winced at a twinge in his neck as he followed it with his eyes. It crashed down not far short of the upper city's walls with a deep boom, throwing chunks of stone far into the slums. A great horn sounded behind the Gurkish lines, a throbbing, rumbling blast. Drums followed behind, thumping together like monstrous footsteps.
"Here they come!" roared Koska. "Ready with your bows!"
Glockta heard the order echoing across the walls, and a moment later the battlements on the towers bristled with loaded flatbows, the bright points of the bolts glinting in the harsh sun. The great wicker shields that marked the Gurkish lines began slowly, steadily to move forwards, edging across the blighted no-man's land towards them. And behind, no doubt, Gurkish soldiers crawl like ants. Glockta's hand clutched the stone of the parapet painfully tight as he watched them come on, his heart beating almost as loud as the Gurkish drums. Fear or excitement? Is there a difference? When was the last time I felt such a bittersweet thrill? Speaking before the open council, leading a charge of the king's cavalry, fighting in the contest before the roaring crowds. The screens were coming steadily closer, still in an even row across the peninsula. Now 100 strides, now 90, now 80. He looked sideways at Koska, still grinning like a madman. When will he give the order? 60? 50?
Now!
Roared the Styrian.
Fire!
There was a mighty rattling along the walls as the flatbows were loosed in one great volley, peppering the screens, the ground around them, the corpses, and any Gurkish unlucky enough to have left some part of their body visible. Men knelt behind the parapet and began to reload, fumbling with bolts, cranking handles, sweating and straining. The drumbeats had grown faster, more urgent, the screens passed heedless over the scattered bodies. Not much fun for the men behind, staring down at the corpses beneath their feet, wondering how long before they join them.
"Oil!"
shouted Koska. A bottle with a burning wick was flung spinning from a tower on the left. It smashed against one of the wicker screens, and lines of fire shot hungrily out across the surface, turning it brown, then black. It began to wobble, to bend, then gradually started to tip over. A soldier ran out howling from behind it, his arm wreathed in bright flames. The burning screen fell to the ground, exposing a column of Gurkish troops, some pushing barrows full of boulders, others carrying long ladders, others with bows, armor, weapons. They yelled their war cries, charging forward with their shields raised, shooting arrows up at the battlements, zigzagging back and forth between the corpses. Men pitched on their faces, riddled with flatbow bolts. Men howled and clutched at wounds. Men crawled and gurgled and swore. They pleaded and bellowed defiance. They ran for the rear and were shot in the back. Up on the walls, bows twanged and clanked. More bottles of oil were lit and hurled down. Some men roared and hissed and spat curses. Some cowered behind the parapet as arrows zipped up from below, clattering from stone or shooting overhead, occasionally thudding into flesh. Koska had one foot up on the battlements, utterly careless, leaning out dangerously far and brandishing a notched sword, bellowing something that Glockta could not hear. Everyone was screaming and shouting, attackers and defenders both. Battle. Chaos. I remember now. How could I ever have enjoyed this? Another of the screens was blazing, filling the air with reeking black smoke. Gurkish soldiers spilled out from behind it like bees from a broken hive, milling around on the far side of the ditch, trying to find a spot to foot their ladder. Defenders further down the walls began to hurl chunks of masonry down at them. Another rock from a catapult crashed down far short and ripped a long hole through a Gurkish column, sending bodies and parts of bodies flying. A soldier was dragged past with an arrow in his eye.
"Is it bad?" he was wailing. "Is it bad?"
A moment later, a man just beside Glockta squawked as a shaft hit him in the chest. He was spun half round, his flat bow went off, and the bolt thudded into his neighbor's neck, right up to the feathers. The two of them fell together right at Glockta's feet, leaking blood across the walkway. Down at the foot of the walls, a bottle of oil burst apart in the midst of a crowd of Gurkish soldiers just as they were trying to raise their ladder. A faint tang of cooking meat joined the stinks of rot and wood smoke. Men burned, scrambling and screaming, charging around madly or flinging themselves into the flooded ditch in full armor. Death by burning or death by drowning, some choice.
"You've seen enough yet?" Severard's voice hissed in his ear.
"Yes, more than enough." He left Koska shouting himself hoarse in Styrian and pushed breathlessly through the press of mercenaries towards the steps. He followed a stretcher down, wincing at every painful step, trying to keep up while a steady stream of men shoved past the other way. "Never thought that I'd be glad to be going down a set of steps again." His happiness did not last long, however. By the time he reached the bottom, his left leg was twitching with the all-too-familiar mixture of agony and numbness.
"Damn it!" he hissed to himself, hopping back against the wall. "There are casualties more mobile than I am."
He watched the wounded hobbling past, bandaged and bloody.
"This isn't right," hissed Severard. "We've done our bit. We found the traitors. What the hell are we still doing here?"
"Fighting for the king's cause beneath you, is it?"
"Dying for it is,"
Glockta snorted.
"You think there's anyone in this whole fucking city enjoying themselves?"
He thought he heard the faint sound of Koska screaming insults floating down over the clamour of the fighting.
"Apart from that crazy Styrian, of course. Keep an eye on him, eh, Severard? He betrayed Ida, he'll betray us, especially if things look bleak."
The practical stared at him, and for once there was no trace of a smile round his eyes.
"Do things look bleak? You were up there."
Glockta grimaced as he stretched his leg out.
"They've looked better."
The long, dim hall had once been a temple. When the Gurkish assaults had begun, the lightly wounded had been brought here to be tended to by priests and women. It was an easy place to bring them, down in the lower city, close to the walls. This part of the slums was mostly empty of civilians now, in any case. "The risks of raging fire and plummeting boulders can quickly render a neighbourhood unpopular." As the fighting continued, the lightly wounded had gone back to the walls, leaving the more serious casualties behind. Those with severed limbs, with deep cuts, with terrible burns, with arrows in the body, lay scattered round the dim arcades on their bloody stretchers. Day by day their numbers had mounted until they choked every part of the floor. The walking wounded were dealt with outside now. This place was reserved for the ruined, for the maimed, for the dying. Every man had his own special language of agony. Some screamed and howled without end. Some cried out for help, for mercy, for water, for their mothers. Some coughed and gurgled and spat blood. Some wheezed and rattled out their last breaths. Only the dead are entirely silent. And there were a lot of them. From time to time you would see them being dragged out, limbs lolling, ready to be wrapped in cheap shrouds and heaped up behind the back wall. All day, Glockta knew, grim teams of men were busy digging graves for the natives. According to their firmly held beliefs, great pits in the ruins of the slums, good for a dozen corpses at a time. All night, the same men were busy burning the Union dead. According to our lack of belief in anything, up on the bluffs where the oily smoke will be carried out over the bay, we can only hope it will blow right into the faces of the Gurkish on the other side. One last insult from us to them. Glockta shuffled slowly through the hall, echoing with the sounds of pain, wiping the sweat from his forehead, peering down at the casualties. Dark-skinned Dagoskins, Styrian mercenaries, pale-skinned Union men, all mixed up together. People of all nations, all colors, all types, united against the Gurkish, and now dying together, side by side, all equal. My heart would be warmed, if I still had one. He was vaguely aware of practical Frost, lurking in the darkness by the wall nearby, eyes moving carefully over the room. My watchful shadow, here to make sure that no one rewards my efforts on the Archlector's behalf with a fatal head wound of my own. A small section at the back of the temple had been curtained off for surgery. Or as close as they can get here. Hack and slash with saw and knife, legs off at the knee, arms at the shoulder. The loudest screams in the whole place came from behind those dirty curtains, desperate, slobbering wails. Hardly any less brutal than what's happening on the other side of the land walls. Glockta could see Kadia working through a gap, his white robe spattered, smeared, turned grubby brown with blood. He was squinting down at some glistening meat while he cut away at it with a blade. The stump of a leg, perhaps? The screams bubbled to a stop. "He's dead," said the Haddish simply, tossing his knife down on the table and wiping his bloody hands on a rag. "Bring in the next one." He lifted the curtain and pushed his way through. Then he saw Glockta. "Ah, the author of our woes. Have you come to feed your guilt, Superior?"
"No, I came to see if I have any."
"And do you?"
"A good question. Do I?"
He looked down at a young man lying on dirty straw by the wall, wedged in between two others. His face was waxy pale, eyes glassy, lips moving rapidly as he mumbled some meaningless nonsense to himself. His leg was off just above the knee, the stump bound with a bloody dressing, a belt buckled tight round the thigh. His chances of survival? Slim to none. A last few hours in agony and squalor, listening to the groans of his fellows. A young life, snuffed out long before his time, and blah, blah, blah. Glockta raised his eyebrows. He felt nothing but a mild distaste. No more than he might have, had the dying man been a heap of rubbish.
"No,"
he said. Kadia looked down at his own bloody hands.
"Then God has truly blessed you," he muttered. "Not everyone has your stomach."
"I don't know. Your people have been fighting well."
"Dying well, you mean?"
Glockta's laughter hacked at the heavy air.
"Come now! There's no such thing as dying well."
He glanced round at the endless wounded.
"I'd have thought that you of all people would have learned that by now."
Kadia did not laugh.
"How much of this do you think we can stand?"
"Losing heart, eh, Haddish? As with so many things in life, heroic last stands are a great deal more appealing in concept than reality."
The dashing young Colonel Glockter could have told us that, dragged away from the bridge, with the remains of his leg barely attached, his notions of how the world works radically altered.
Your concern is touching, Superior, but I'm used to disappointments. Believe me, I will live with this one. The question remains, how long can we hold out?
If the sea lanes stay open and we can be supplied by ship, if the Gurkish cannot find a way round the land walls, if we can stick together and keep our heads, we could hold out here for weeks.
Hold out for what?
Glockter paused. For what indeed?
Perhaps the Gurkish will lose heart.
Ha! Snorted Cadia. The Gurkish have no hearts. They did not subdue all Kanto with half measures. No, the Emperor has spoken and will not be denied.
Then we must hope that the war will be quickly settled in the north, and that Union forces will come to our aid. An utterly futile hope. It will be months before matters are settled in Angland. Even when they are, the army will be in no state to fight. We are on our own.
And when might we expect such help?
When the stars go out, when the sky falls in, when I run a mile with a smile on my face.
If I had all the answers, I'd hardly have joined the Inquisition, snapped Glockter. Perhaps you should pray for divine help. A mighty wave to wash the Gurkish away would suit nicely. Who was it told me that miracles happen?
Cadia nodded slowly.
Perhaps we should both pray. I fear there is more chance of aid from my god than your master's.
Another stretcher was carried past, a squealing Styrian stretched out on it with an arrow in his stomach.
I must go.
Cadia swept away, and the curtain dropped back behind him. Glockter frowned at it. And so the doubts begin. The Gurkish slowly tighten their grip on the city. Our doom draws nearer, and every man sees it. A strange thing, death. Far away you can laugh at it, but as it comes closer, it looks worse and worse. Close enough to touch, and no one laughs. Dagoska is full of fear, and the doubts can only grow. Sooner or later someone will try to betray the city to the Gurkish, if only to save their lives, or the lives of those they love. They might well begin by disposing of the troublesome superior who set this madness in motion.
He felt a sudden touch on his shoulder, and he caught his breath and spun round. His leg buckled, and he stumbled back against a pillar, almost treading on a gasping native with bandages across his face. Vitari was standing behind him, frowning.
"Damn it!"
Glockter bit on his lip with his remaining teeth against a searing spasm in his leg.
"Didn't anyone ever teach you not to sneak up on people?"
"They taught me the opposite. I need to talk to you."
"Then talk. Just don't touch me again."
She eyed the wound.
"Not here, alone."
"Oh, come now. What can you have to say to me that you can't say in front of a room full of dying heroes?"
"You'll find out when we get outside."
A chain around the throat, nice and tight, courtesy of His Eminence, or merely some chat about the weather. Glockter felt himself smiling. "I can hardly wait to find out." He held one hand up to Frost, and the albino faded back into the shadows. Then he limped after Vitari, threading their way through the groaning casualties and out through the door at the back into the open air. The sharp smell of sweat swapped for the sharp smell of burning, and something else. Long lozenge shapes were stacked up shoulder-high against the wall of the temple, swathed in rough grey cloth, some of it spotted and stained with brown blood. A whole heap of them. Corpses, waiting patiently to be buried. This morning's harvest. What a wonderfully macabre spot for a pleasant little chat. I could hardly have picked a better.
"So, how are you enjoying the siege? It's a bit noisy for my taste, but your friend Koska seems to like it."
"Where's Ida?"
"What?"
snapped Glockter, stalling for time while he thought about how to answer.
I hardly expected her to find out about that so soon.
Ida, you remember, dressed like an expensive whore, adornment to the city's ruling council, tried to betray us to the Gurkish. Her cell's empty. Why?
Oh, her. She's at sea. True. With 50 strides of good chain round her. False. She's adorning the bottom of the bay now, since you ask. Vitari's orange brows drew in with suspicion.
Why wasn't I told?
I've got better things to do than keep you informed. We've a war to lose, or hadn't you noticed? Glockter turned away, but her hand shot out in front of him and slapped onto the wall, her long arm barring his path.
Keeping me informed means keeping Salt informed. If we start telling him different stories...
Where have you been the last few weeks? He chuckled as he gestured at the pile of shrouded shapes beside the wall. It's a funny thing. The closer the Gurkish get to breaking through our walls and murdering every living thing in Dagoska, the less I seem to care about his fucking eminence. Tell him what you please. You're boring me. He made to push past her arm, but found it did not move.
What if I were to tell him what you please?
She whispered. Glockter frowned. Now that isn't boring. Salt's favorite practical sent here to make sure I tread the righteous path, offering deals, a trick, a trap. Their faces were no more than a foot apart, and he stared hard into her eyes, trying to guess what she was thinking. Is there just the slightest trace of desperation there? Could the motive be nothing more than simple self-preservation? When you lose the instinct yourself, it's hard to remember how powerful it is for everyone else. He felt himself starting to smile. Yes, I see it now. You thought you'd be recalled once the traitors have been found, didn't you? You thought Salt would arrange a nice little boat home. But now there are no boats for anyone, and you're worried your kindly uncle's forgotten all about you, that you've been tossed to the Gurkish with the rest of the damn dog meat. Vitari's eyes narrowed.
Let me tell you a secret. I didn't choose to be here any more than you did. But I learned a long time ago that when Salt tells you to do a thing, you'd better look like you did it. All I care about is getting out of here alive.
She moved even closer.
Can we help each other?
Can we indeed, I wonder. All right, then. I dare say I can squeeze one extra friend into the social world that is my life. I'll see what I can do for you.
You'll see what you can do?
That's the best you'll get. The fact is, I'm not much good at helping people. Out of practice, you see. He leered his toothless grin in her face, lifted her slack arm out of the way with his cane, then hobbled past the heap of bodies and back towards the temple door.
What shall I tell Salt about Ida?
Tell him the truth, Glockter called over his shoulder. Tell him she's dead. Tell him we all are. Chapter 28. So this is pain.
Where am I?
Asked Giselle, only his jaw would not move. The cartwheels squealed as they turned, everything blinding bright and blurry, sound and light digging into his aching skull. He tried to swallow, but could not. He tried to raise his head. Pain stabbed through his neck and his stomach heaved.
Help!
He squealed, but nothing came out beyond a bubbling croak. What had happened? Painful sky above, painful boards underneath. He was lying in a cart, head on a scratchy sack, bouncing and jolting. There had been a fight, he remembered that. A fight among the stones. Someone had called out. A crunch and blinding light, then nothing but pain. Even trying to think was painful. He lifted his arm to feel his face, but found that he couldn't. He tried to shift his legs, to push himself up, but he couldn't do that either. He worked his mouth, grunting, moaning. His tongue was unfamiliar, 3 times its usual size, like a bloody lump of ham that had been shoved between his jaws, filling his mouth so he could hardly breathe. The right side of his face was a mask of agony. With every lurch of the cart, his jaws rattled together, sending white-hot stabs of pain from his teeth into his eyes, his neck, the very roots of his hair. There were bandages over his mouth. He had to breathe through the left side, but even the air moving in his throat was painful. Panic started to claw at him. Every part of his body was screaming. One arm was bound tight across his chest, but he clutched weakly at the side of the cart with the other, trying to do something, anything, his eyes bulging, heart hammering, breath snorting in his nose. He growled. And the more he tried to speak, the more the pain grew and grew, until it seemed his face would split, until it seemed his skull would fly apart.
Easy.
A scarred face swam into view above. 9 fingers. Giselle grabbed at him wildly, and the Northman caught his hand in his own big paw and squeezed it tight.
Easy now, and listen to me. It hurts, yes. Seems like more than you can take, but it isn't. You think you're going to die, but you won't. Listen to me, because I've been there and I know. Each minute, each hour, each day, it gets better.
He felt 9 fingers' other hand on his shoulder, pushing him gently back down into the cart.
All you gotta do is lie there, and it gets better. You understand? You got the light duty, you lucky bastard.
Giselle let his limbs go heavy. All he had to do was lie there. He squeezed the big hand, and the hand squeezed back. The pain seemed less, awful still, but within his control. His breath slowed. His eyes closed. The wind cut over the cold plain, plucking at the short grass, tugging at Giselle's tattered coat, at his greasy hair, at his dirty bandages, but he ignored it. What could he do about the wind? What could he do about anything? He sat, his back against the wheel of the cart, and stared down wide-eyed at his leg. A broken length of spear shaft had been strapped to either side, wrapped round and round with strips of torn-up cloth, held firmly and painfully straight. His arm was no better, sandwiched between 2 slats from a shield and bound tightly across his chest, the white hand dangling, fingers numb and useless as sausages. Pitiful, improvised efforts at medicine that Giselle could never see working. They might almost have seemed amusing, had he not been the unfortunate patient. He would surely never recover. He was broken, shattered, ruined. Would he be now a cripple of the kind he avoided on the street corners of Adua? War-wounded, ragged and dirty, shoving their stumps in the faces of passers-by, holding their crabbing palms out for coppers, uncomfortable reminders that there was a dark side to soldiering that one would rather not think about. Would he be now a cripple like, and a horrible coldness crept over him, like Sandan Glockta? He tried to shift his leg and groaned at the pain. Would he walk for the rest of his life with a stick? A shambling horror, shunned and avoided? A salutary lesson pointed at and whispered of? There goes Giselle Dan Luther. He used to be a promising man, a handsome man. He won a contest, and the crowd cheered for him. Who would believe it? What a waste. What a shame. Here he comes. Let's move on. And that was before he even thought about what his face might look like. He tried to move his tongue, and the stab of agony made him grimace, and he could tell there was a terribly unfamiliar geography to the inside of his mouth. It felt slanted, twisted, nothing fitted together as it used to. There was a gap in his teeth that felt a mile wide. His lips tingled unpleasantly under the bandages, torn, battered, ripped open. He was a monster. A shadow fell across Giselle's face, and he squinted up into the sun. 9 fingers stood over him, a water skin hanging from one big fist.
Water,
he grunted. Giselle shook his head, but the Northman squatted down, pulled the stopper from the skin, and held it out regardless.
Got a drink. Keep it clean.
Giselle snatched the skin bad-temperedly from him, lifted it gingerly to the better side of his mouth, and tried to tilt it. It hung bloated and baggy. He struggled for a moment, before realizing there was no way of drinking with only one good hand. He fell back, eyes closed, snorting through his nose. He almost ground his teeth with frustration, but quickly thought better of it.
Here.
He felt a hand slide behind his neck and firmly lift his head. He grunted furiously, with half a mind to struggle, but in the end he allowed his body to sag and submitted to the ignominy of being handled like a baby. What was the point, after all, in pretending he was anything other than utterly helpless? Sour, lukewarm water seeped into his mouth, and he tried to force it down. It was like swallowing broken glass. He coughed and spat the rest out. Or he tried to spit and found the pain far too great. He had to lean forward and let it dribble from his face, most of it running down his neck and into the filthy collar of his shirt. He sat back heavily with a moan and pushed the skin away with his good hand. Nine Fingers shrugged.
All right, but you'll have to try again later. Gotta keep drinking. You remember what happened?
Giselle shook his head.
There was a fight. Me and Sunshine there, and he nodded over at Pharaoh, who scowled back, handled most of them, but it seems three got around us. You dealt with two, and you did well with that. But you missed one, and he hit you in the mouth with a mace.
He gestured at Giselle's bandaged face.
Hit you hard, and you're familiar with the outcome. Then you fell, and I'm guessing he hit you when you were down, which is how you got the arm and the leg broke. Could have been a lot worse. If I was you, I'd be thanking the dead that Kwai was there.
Giselle blinked over at the apprentice. What did he have to do with anything? But Nine Fingers was already answering his question.
Came up and knocked him on the head with a pan. Well, I say knocked. Smashed his skull to mush, didn't you?
He grinned over at the apprentice, who sat staring out across the plain.
He hits hard for a thin man, our boy, eh? Shame about that pan, though.
Kwai shrugged as though he stove a man's head in most mornings. Giselle supposed he should be thanking the sickly fool for saving his life, but he didn't feel so very saved. Instead, he tried to form the sounds as clearly as he could without hurting himself, making little more than a whisper.
How bad is it?
I've had worse. Small comfort indeed. You'll get through all right. You're young. Arm and leg'll mend quick.
Meaning, Giselle inferred, that his face would not.
Always tough taking a wound, and never tougher than the first. I cried like a baby at every one of these.
And Nine Fingers waved a hand at his battered face.
Most everyone cries, and that's a fact, if it's any help.
It was not.
How bad?
Nine Fingers scratched at the thick stubble on the side of his face.
Your jaws broke, you lost some teeth, you got your mouth ripped, but we stitched you up pretty good.
Giselle swallowed, hardly able to think. His worst fears seemed to be confirmed.
It's a hard wound you got there, and a nasty place to get it. In your mouth, so you can't eat, can't drink, can't hardly talk without pain. Can't kiss either, of course, though that shouldn't be a problem out here, eh?
The Northman grinned, but Giselle was in no mood to join him.
A bad wound, all right. A naming wound, they'd call it, where I come from.
A what?
Muttered Giselle, immediately regretting it as pain licked at his jaw.
A naming wound, you know.
And Nine Fingers waggled the stump of his finger.
A wound you could get named after. They'd probably call you Broke Jaw, or Bent Face, or Lack Teeth, or something.
He smiled again, but Giselle had left his sense of humour on the hill among the stones, along with his broken teeth. He could feel tears stinging at his eyes. He wanted to cry, but that made his mouth stretch, the stitches tug at his bloated lips under the bandages. Nine Fingers made a further effort.
You gotta look at the bright side.
It ain't likely to kill you now. If the rot was going to get into it, I reckon it would have already.
Giselle gawped, horrified, eyes going wider and wider as the implications of that last utterance sank in. His jaw would surely have dropped had it not been shattered and bound tightly to his face. Wasn't likely to kill him. The possibility of the wound going bad had never even occurred. Rot in his mouth?
I'm not helping, am I? Muttered Logan.
Giselle covered his eyes with his one good hand and tried to weep without hurting himself, silent sobs making his shoulders shake. They had stopped on the shore of a wide lake, choppy grey water under a dark sky heavy with bruises. Brooding water, brooding sky, all seeming full of secrets, full of threats. Sullen waves slapped at the cold shingle. Sullen birds croaked to one another above the water. Sullen pain pulsed through every corner of Giselle's body and would not stop. Pharaoh squatted down in front of him, frowning, as always, cutting the bandages away, while Baez stood behind her looking down. The first of the Magi had woken from his torpor, it seemed. He had given no explanation of what had caused it, or why he had so suddenly recovered, but he still looked ill, older than ever, and a lot bonier, his eyes sunken, his skin looking somehow thin, pale, almost transparent. But Giselle had no sympathy to spare, especially not for the architect of this disaster.
"Where are we?"
he muttered through the twinges. It was less painful to talk than it had been, but he still had to speak quietly, carefully, the words thick and stumbling like some village half-wits. Baez nodded over his shoulder towards the great expanse of water.
"This is the first of the three lakes. We are well on the way to Alcus. More than half of our journey is behind us, I would say."
Giselle swallowed. Halfway was hardly the greatest reassurance he could have asked for.
"How long was—"
"I can't work with you flapping your lips, fool," hissed Pharaoh. "Do I leave you like this, or do you shut up?"
Giselle shut up. She peeled the dressing carefully from his face, peered down at the brown blood on the cloth, sniffed it, wrinkled her nose and tossed it away, then stared angrily at his mouth for a moment. He swallowed, watching her dark face for any sign of what she might be thinking. He would have given his teeth for a mirror at that moment, if he had still had a full set.
"How bad is it?"
he muttered at her, tasting blood on his tongue. She scowled up at him.
"You've confused me with someone who cares."
A sob coughed up from his throat. Tears stung at his eyes. He had to look away and blink to stop himself crying. He was a pitiable specimen, all right. A brave son of the Union, a bold officer of the King's Own, a winner of the contest, no less, and he could scarcely keep from weeping.
"Hold this," snapped Pharaoh's voice.
"Ooh,"
he whispered, trying to press the sobs down into his chest and stop them cracking his voice. He held one end of the fresh bandage against his face while she wrapped it round his head and under his jaw, round and round, holding his mouth near shut.
"You'll live."
"Is that supposed to be a comfort?"
he mumbled. She shrugged as she turned away.
"There are plenty you don't."
Giselle almost envied them as he watched her stalk off through the waving grass. How he wished Ardy was here. He remembered the last sight of her, looking up at him in the soft rain with that crooked smile. She would never have left him like this, helpless and in pain. She would have spoken soft words and touched his face and looked at him with her dark eyes and kissed him gently and... sentimental shit. Probably she had found some other idiot to tease and confuse and make miserable, and had never paid him so much as a second thought. He tortured himself with the thought of her laughing at some other man's jokes, smiling into some other man's face, kissing some other man's mouth. She would never want him now, that was sure. No one would want him. He felt his lip trembling again, his eyes tingling.
All the great heroes of old, you know, the great kings, the great generals, they all faced adversity from time to time. Giselle looked up. He'd almost forgotten that Baez was there. Suffering is what gives a man strength, my boy, just as the steel most hammered turns out the hardest. The old man winced as he squatted down beside Giselle. Anyone can face ease and success with confidence. It is the way we face trouble and misfortune that defines us. Self-pity goes with selfishness, and there is nothing more to be deplored in a leader than that. Selfishness belongs to children and to half-wits. A great leader puts others before himself. You would be surprised how acting so makes it easier to bear one's own troubles. In order to act like a king, one need only treat everyone else like one. And he placed a hand on Giselle's shoulder. Perhaps it was supposed to be a fatherly and reassuring touch, but he could feel it trembling through his shirt. Baez let it rest there for a moment, as though he had not the strength to move it, then pushed himself slowly up, stretched his legs, and shuffled off. Giselle stared vacantly after him. A few weeks ago he would have been left fuming silently by such a lecture. Now he sat limp and absorbed it meekly. He hardly knew who he was any more. It was difficult to maintain any sense of superiority in the face of his utter dependence on other people, and people of whom, until recently, he had held such a very low opinion. He was no longer under any illusions. Without Pharaoh's savage doctoring and Nine-Fingers' clumsy nursing, he would most likely have been dead. The Northman was walking over, boots crunching in the shingle. Time to go back in the cart. Time for more squeaking and jolting. Time for more pain. Giselle gave a long, ragged, self-pitying sigh, but stopped himself halfway through. Self-pity was for children and half-wits. All right, you know the drill. Giselle leaned forward and Nine-Fingers hooked his arm behind his back, the other under his knees, lifted him up over the side of the cart without even breathing hard, and dumped him unceremoniously among the supplies. Giselle caught his big, dirty, three-fingered hand as he was moving away, and the Northman turned to look at him, one heavy brow lifted. Giselle swallowed.
Thank you,
he muttered.
What, for this?
For everything.
Nine-Fingers looked at him for a long moment, then shrugged.
Nothing to it. You treat folk the way you'd want to be treated, and you can't go far wrong. That's what my father told me. Forgot that advice for a long time, and I done things I could never make up for.
He gave a long sigh.
Still, it doesn't hurt to try. My experience, you get what you give in the end.
Giselle blinked at Nine-Fingers' broad back as he walked over to his horse. You treat folk the way you'd want to be treated. Could Giselle honestly say that he had ever done that much? He thought about it as the cart set off, axles shrieking, carelessly at first, and then with deepening worry. He had bullied his juniors, pandered to his seniors. He had often screwed money from friends who could not afford it, had taken advantage of girls, then brushed them off. He had never once thanked his friend West for any of his help, and would happily have bedded his sister behind his back if she had let him. He realized, with increasing horror, that he could scarcely think of a single selfless thing that he had ever done. He shifted uncomfortably against the sacks of fodder in the cart. You get what you give in the long run, and manners cost nothing. From now on, he would think of others first. He would treat everyone as if they were his equal. But later, of course, there would be plenty of time to be a better man when he could eat again. He touched one hand to the bandages on his face, scratched absently at them, then had to stop himself. Baez was riding just behind the cart, looking out across the water.
You saw it?
Giselle muttered at him.
Saw what?
This.
He jabbed a finger at his face.
Ah, that. Yes, I saw it.
How bad is it?
Baez cocked his head on one side.
Do you know,
All in all, I believe I like it.
You like it?
Not now, perhaps, but the stitches will come out, the swelling will go down, the bruises will fade, the scabs will heal and drop away. I would guess your jaw will never quite regain its shape, and your teeth, of course, will not grow back, but what you lose in boyish charm, you will gain, I have no doubt, in a certain danger, a flair, a rugged mystery. People respect a man who has seen action, and your appearance will be very far from ruined. I dare say girls could still be persuaded to swoon for you, if you were to do anything worth swooning over. He nodded thoughtfully. Yes, all in all, I think it will serve.
Serve?
Muttered Giselle, one hand pressed against his bandages.
Serve what?
But Byers's mind had wandered off. Harold the Great had a scar, you know, across his cheek, and it never did him any harm. You don't see it on the statues, of course, but people respected him the more for it in life. Truly a great man, Harold. He had a shining reputation for being fair and trustworthy, and indeed he often was. But he knew how not to be when the situation demanded it. The Magus chuckled to himself. Did I tell you of the time he invited his two greatest enemies to negotiate with him? He had them feuding one with the other before the day was out, and later they destroyed each other's armies in battle, leaving him to claim victory over both without striking a blow. He knew, you see, that Ardlick had a beautiful wife. Giselle lay back in the cart. Byers had, in fact, told him that story before, but there seemed no purpose in saying so. He was actually enjoying hearing it for a second time, and it was hardly as though there was anything better for him to do. There was something calming in the repetitive droning of the old man's deep voice, especially now the sun was breaking through the clouds. His mouth was barely even hurting, if he kept it still. So Giselle lay back against a sack of straw, head turned to the side, rocking gently with the movement of the cart, and watched the land slide by, watched the wind in the grass, watched the sun on the water. Chapter 29 One Step at a Time. West gritted his teeth as he dragged himself up the freezing slope. His fingers were numb and weak and trembling from clawing at the chill earth, the icy tree roots, the freezing snow for handholds. His lips were cracked, his nose was endlessly running, the rims of his nostrils were horribly sore. The very air cut into his throat and nipped at his lungs, smoked back out in tickling wheezes. He wondered if giving his coat to Ladislaw had been the worst decision of his life. He decided it probably had been, except for saving the selfish bastard in the first place, of course. Even when he had been training for the contest 5 hours a day, he had never imagined that he could be so tired. Next to three trees, Lord Marshal Veruz seemed an almost laughably soft taskmaster. West was shaken awake before dawn every morning, and scarcely allowed to rest until after the last light faded. The Northmen were machines, every one of them. Men carved from wood, who never got tired, who felt no pain. Every one of West's muscles ached from their merciless pace. He was covered in bruises and scratches from 100 falls and scrambles. His feet were raw and blistered in his wet boots. Then there was the familiar pulsing in the head, throbbing away to the rhythm of his labored heartbeat, mingling unpleasantly with the burning of the wound on his scalp. The cold, the pain, and the fatigue were bad enough, but still worse was the overwhelming sense of shame and guilt and failure that crushed him down with every step. He had been sent with Ladislaw to make sure there were no disasters. The result had been a disaster on a scale almost incomprehensible. An entire division massacred. How many children without fathers? How many wives without husbands? How many parents without sons? If only he could have done more, he told himself for the thousandth time, bunching his bloodless hands into fists.
If only he could have convinced the prince to stay behind the river, all those men might not be dead. So many dead. He hardly knew whether to pity or envy them.
"One step at a time,"
he muttered to himself as he clambered up the slope. That was the only way to look at it.